becomes like the proverbial frog cooked alive without noticing. When your conscience finally rebels and draws a line in the sand, we know that it is likely to be an arbitrary one, fueled by implicit subterranean forces. Despite your best attempts at pseudo-speciation, this victim's face reminds you of a loved one's. A smell just wafted by that took you back to childhood and reminds you of how life once felt innocent. Your anterior cingulate neurons just had breakfast. At such times, a line having finally been drawn must be more important than its arbitrariness. The second issue concerns responsibility. When debriefed afterward, compliant teachers typically cited how persuasive they found the information that the learner had been informed of the risks and had given consent. Don't worry, you won't be held responsible. The Milgram phenomenon also showed the coercive power of misdirecting responsibility. When researchers would seek compliance by emphasizing that the teacher's responsibility was to the project, not the learner, "I thought you said you were here to help. You're a team member. You're ruining things. You signed a form." It's hard enough to respond with, "This isn't the job I signed up for." It's that much harder when the fine print reveals that this is what you signed up for. Compliance increases when guilt is diffused. Even if I hadn't done it, it still would have happened. Statistical guilt. This is why, historically, people were not executed with 5 shots fired from 1 gun. Instead, there were 5 guns fired simultaneously. A firing squad. Firing squads traditionally took the diffusion of responsibility a step further, where one member was randomly given a blank instead of a real bullet. That way, a shooter could shift from the comforting irrationality that "I only 1/5 killed him," to the even better, "I may not even have shot him." This tradition was translated into modern execution technology. Lethal injection machines used in prison executions come with a dual control system. 2 syringes, each filled with a lethal dose, 2 separate delivery systems, 2 buttons pressed simultaneously by 2 different people, at which point a random binary generator would secretly determine which syringe was emptied into a bucket and which into a human. And then the record would be erased, allowing each person to think, "Hey, I may not even have given him any drug." Finally, responsibility is diffused by anonymity. This comes de facto if the group is large enough, and large groups also facilitate individual efforts at anonymity. During the Chicago riots of 1968, many police notoriously covered their name tags before setting on the unarmed anti-war demonstrators. Groups also facilitate conformity by institutionalizing anonymity. Examples range from the KKK to Star Wars Imperial Stormtroopers, to the finding that in traditional human societies, warriors who transform and standardize their appearance before battle are more likely to torture and mutilate their enemies than warriors from cultures that don't transform themselves. All use means to de-individuate, where the goal may not be to ensure that a victimized them won't be able to recognize you afterward, as much as to facilitate moral disengagement so that you won't be able to recognize you afterward. The nature of the victim. No surprise, compliance becomes easier when the victim is an abstraction, say, the future generations who will inherit this planet. In Milgram follow-ups, compliance declined if the learner was in the same room as the teacher, and would plummet if the two had shaken hands. Ditto if psychological distance was shortened by perspective taking. What would it feel like if you were in their shoes? Predictably, compliance is also decreased when the victim is individuated. However, don't let the authority individuate victims for you. In one classic Milgram-esque study, the scientists would accidentally allow a teacher to overhear their opinion of the learner. "Seems like a nice guy," versus "this guy seems like an animal." Guess who'd get more shocks? Authorities rarely ask us to administer shocks to those whom they label as nice guys. It's always to the animals. Implicit in the latter categorizations evoking more compliance is our having ceded power to the authorities or to the group to create the narrative. One of the greatest wellsprings of resistance is to seize back the narrative, from children of exceptionalities to the Paralympics, from gay pride marches to Never Again, from Hispanic Heritage Month to James Brown singing Say It Out Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, a major step toward victims' resistance is to gain the power to define themselves. Things brought to the table by the person being pressured. Some personality traits predict resistance to the pressure to comply. Not valuing being conscientious or agreeable. Being low in neuroticism. Scoring low on right-wing authoritarianism. Any particular authority is more likely to be questioned if you already question the very concept of authority. Social intelligence, which may be mediated by an enhanced ability to understand things like scapegoating or ulterior motives. And where these individual differences come from is, of course, the end product of most of the preceding chapters. What about gender? Milgram-like studies have shown that women average higher rates than men of voicing resistance to the demands to obey, but higher rates, nonetheless, of ultimately complying. Other studies show that women have higher rates than men of public conformity and lower rates of private conformity. Overall, though, gender is not much of a predictor. Interestingly, rates of conformity in Ash-like studies increase in mixed-sex groups. When in the presence of the opposite sex, perhaps there's less desire to seem like a rugged individualist than fear of seeming foolish. Finally, of course, we are the products of our culture. In broad cross-cultural surveys, Milgram and others showed more compliance in subjects from collectivist than from individualist cultures. Stress. Exactly as with us theming, people are more likely to conform and obey at times of stress, ranging from time pressure to a real or imagined outside threat to a novel context. In stressful settings, rules gain power. Alternatives. Finally, there is the key issue of whether you perceive alternatives to the actions demanded of you. It can be a solitary task to reframe and reappraise a situation, to make the implicit explicit, to engage in perspective taking, to question, to imagine that resistance is not futile. A huge help in doing that is evidence that you are not alone. From Ash and Milgram on, it's clear that the presence of anyone else pushing back against the pressure can be galvanizing. 10 against 2 in a jury room is a world of difference from 11 against 1. One lone voice crying out in the wilderness is a crank. 2 voices joined together form a nidus of resistance, offer the start of an oppositional social identity. It certainly helps to know that you are not alone, that there are others who are willing to resist, that there are those who have done so in the past. But often, something still holds us back. Eichmann's seeming normalcy supplied us, thanks to Hannah Arendt, with the notion of the banality of evil. Zimbardo, in his recent writing, emphasizes the banality of heroism. As discussed in various chapters, people who heroically refuse to look the other way, who do the right thing even when it carries the ultimate cost, tend to be surprisingly normal. The stars didn't align at their births. Doves of peace did not envelop them where they strode. They put their pants on one leg at a time. This should be a huge source of strength for us. Summary and conclusions. We're just like numerous other social species in terms of having marked status differences among individuals and hierarchies that emerge from those differences. Like many of these other species, we're fantastically attuned to status differences, are sufficiently fascinated by them that we monitor status relations in individuals who are irrelevant to us and can perceive status differences in a blink of an eye. And we find it deeply unsettling with the amygdala leading front and center when status relations are ambiguous and shifting. As in so many other species, our brains, particularly the neocortex, and most particularly the frontal cortex, have co-evolved with the social complexity of status differences. It takes a lot of brain power to make sense of the subtleties of dominance relations. This is no surprise, given that knowing your place can be so contextual. Navigating status differences is most challenging when it comes to attaining and maintaining high rank. This requires cognitive mastery of theory of mind and perspective taking, of manipulation, intimidation, and deceit, and of impulse control and emotion regulation. As with so many other primates, the biographies of our most hierarchically successful members are built around what provocations are ignored during occasions where the frontal cortex kept a level head. Our bodies and brains, like those of other social species, bear the imprint of social status, and having the wrong rank can be corrosively pathogenic. Moreover, the physiology is not so much about rank per se, as about its social meaning in your species and particular group, the behavioral advantages and disadvantages, and the psychological baggage of a particular rank. And then we're unlike any other species on Earth in that we belong to multiple hierarchies, are psychologically adept at overvaluing those in which we excel, and maintain internal standards that can trump objective rank in their impact. Humans committed themselves to a unique trajectory when we invented socioeconomic status. In terms of its caustic, scarring impact on minds and bodies, nothing in the history of animals being crappy to one another about status differences comes within light years of our invention of poverty. We're really out there as a species in that sometimes our high-status individuals don't merely plunder and instead actually lead, actually attempt to facilitate the common good. We've even developed bottom-up mechanisms for collectively choosing such leaders on occasion, a magnificent achievement, which we then soil by having our choosing of leaders be shaped by implicit, automatic factors more suitable to five-year-olds deciding who should captain their boat on a voyage with the Teletubbies to Candyland. Stripped to their idealistic core, our political differences concern differing visions of how best to bring about the common good. We tend to come as internally consistent packages of political stances, ranging from the small and local to the mammoth and global. And with remarkable regularity, our stances reflect our implicit, affective makeup, with cognition playing post-hoc catch-up. If you really want to understand someone's politics, understand their cognitive load, how prone they are to snap judgments, their approaches to reappraisal and resolving cognitive dissonance. Even more important, understand how they feel about novelty, ambiguity, empathy, hygiene, disease, and dis-ease, and whether things used to be better and the future is a scary place. Like so many other animals, we have an often frantic need to conform, belong, and obey. Such conformity can be markedly maladaptive as we forgo better solutions in the name of the foolishness of the crowd. When we discover we are out of step with everyone else, our amygdala spasm with anxiety, our memories are revised, and our sensory processing regions are even pressured to experience what is not true. All to fit in. Finally, the pull of conformity and obedience can lead us to some of our darkest, most appalling places, and far more of us can be led there than we'd like to think. But despite that, even the worst of barrels doesn't turn all apples bad, and resistance and heroism are often more accessible and less rarefied and capitalized than assumed. We're rarely alone in thinking this is wrong, wrong, wrong. And we are usually no less special or unique than those before us who have fought back. Chapter 13. Morality and doing the right thing, once you've figured out what that is. The two previous chapters examined the thoroughly unique contexts for some human behaviors that are on a continuum with behaviors in other species. Like some other species, we make automatic us-them dichotomies and favor the former, though only humans rationalize that tendency with ideology. Like many other species, we are implicitly hierarchical, though only humans view the gap between haves and have-nots as a divine plan. This chapter considers another domain rife with human uniqueness, namely morality. For us, morality is not only belief in norms of appropriate behavior, but also the belief that they should be shared and transmitted culturally. Work in the field is dominated by a familiar sort of question. When we make a decision regarding morality, is it mostly the outcome of moral reasoning or of moral intuition? Do we mostly think or feel our way to deciding what is right? This raises a related question. Is human morality as new as the cultural institutions we've hatched in recent millennia, or are its rudiments a far older primate legacy? This raises more questions. What's more impressive, consistencies and universalities of human moral behavior, or variability and its correlation with cultural and ecological factors? Finally, there will be unapologetically prescriptive questions. When it comes to moral decision-making, when is it better to rely on intuition, when on reasoning? And when we resist temptation, is it mostly an act of will or of grace? People have confronted these issues since students attended intro philosophy in togas. Naturally, these questions are informed by science. The primacy of reasoning in moral decision-making. One single fact perfectly demonstrates moral decision-making being based on cognition and reasoning. Have you ever picked up a law textbook? They're humongous. Every society has rules about moral and ethical behavior that are reasoned and call upon logical operations. Applying the rules requires reconstructing scenarios, understanding proximal and distal causes of events, and assessing magnitudes and probabilities of consequences of actions. Assessing individual behavior requires perspective taking, theory of mind, and distinguishing between outcome and intent. Moreover, in many cultures, rule implementation is typically entrusted to people, e.g., lawyers, clergy, who have undergone long training. Harking back to Chapter 7, the primacy of reasoning in moral decision-making is anchored in child development. The Kohlbergian emergence of increasingly complex stages of moral development is built on the Piagetian emergence of increasingly complex logical operations. They are similar neurobiologically. Logical and moral reasoning about the correctness of an economic or ethical decision, respectively, both activate the cognitive DLPFC. People with obsessive-compulsive disorder get mired in both everyday decision-making and moral decision-making, and their DLPFCs go wild with activity for both. Similarly, there's activation of the temporoparietal junction, TPJ, during theory of mind tasks, whether they are perceptual, e.g., visualizing a complex scene from another viewer's perspective, amoral, e.g., keeping straight who's in love with whom in A Midsummer Night's Dream, or moral/social, e.g., inferring the ethical motivation behind a person's act. Moreover, the more the TPJ activation, the more people take intent into account when making moral judgments, particularly when there was intent to harm, but no actual harm done. Most important, inhibit the TPJ with transcranial magnetic stimulation, and subjects become less concerned about intent. The cognitive processes we bring to moral reasoning aren't perfect, in that there are fault lines of vulnerability, imbalances, and asymmetries. For example, doing harm is worse than allowing it. For equivalent outcomes, we typically judge commission more harshly than omission and must activate the DLPFC more to judge them as equal. This makes sense. When we do one thing, there are innumerable other things we didn't do. No wonder the former is psychologically weightier. As another cognitive skew, as discussed in Chapter 10, we're better at detecting violations of social contracts that have malevolent rather than benevolent consequences, e.g., giving less versus more than promised. We also search harder for causality and come up with more false attributions for malevolent than for benevolent events. This was shown in one study. First scenario. A worker proposes a plan to the boss, saying, "If we do this, there'll be big profits and we'll harm the environment in the process." The boss answers, "I don't care about the environment, just do it." Second scenario, same setup, but this time there'll be big profits and benefits to the environment. Boss, "I don't care about the environment, just do it." In the first scenario, 85% of subjects stated that the boss harmed the environment in order to increase profits. However, in the second scenario, only 23% said that the boss helped the environment in order to increase profits. Okay, we're not perfect reasoning machines. But that's our goal, and numerous moral philosophers emphasize the preeminence of reasoning, where emotion and intuition, if they happen to show up, just soil the carpet. Such philosophers range from Kant, with his search for a mathematics of morality, to Princeton philosopher Peter Singer, who kvetches that if things like sex and bodily functions are pertinent to philosophizing, time to hang up his spurs. It would be best to forget all about our particular moral judgments. Morality is anchored in reason. Yeah, sure it is. Social intuitionism. Except, there's a problem with this conclusion. People often haven't a clue why they've made some judgment, yet they fervently believe it's correct. This is straight out of Chapter 11's rapid implicit assessments of us versus them and our post hoc rational justifications for visceral prejudice. Scientists studying moral philosophy increasingly emphasize moral decision-making as implicit, intuitive, and anchored in emotion. The king of this social intuitionist school is Jonathan Haidt, whom we've encountered previously. Haidt views moral decisions as primarily based on intuition, and believes reasoning is what we then use to convince everyone, including ourselves, that we're making sense. In an apt phrase of Haidt's, moral thinking is for social doing, and sociality always has an emotional component. The evidence for the social intuitionist school is plentiful. When contemplating moral decisions, we don't just activate the egg-heady DLPFC. There's also activation of the usual emotional cast, amygdala, VMPFC, and the related orbitofrontal cortex, insular cortex, anterior cingulate. Different types of moral transgressions preferentially activate different subsets of these regions. For example, moral quandaries eliciting pity preferentially activate the insula. Those eliciting indignation activate the orbitofrontal cortex. Quandaries generating intense conflict preferentially activate the anterior cingulate. Finally, for acts assessed as equally morally wrong, those involving non-sexual transgressions, e.g. stealing from a sibling, activate the amygdala, whereas those involving sexual transgressions, e.g. sex with a sibling, also activate the insula. Moreover, when such activation is strong enough, we also activate the sympathetic nervous system and feel arousal, and we know how those peripheral effects feed back and influence behavior. When we confront a moral choice, the DLPFC doesn't adjudicate in contemplative silence. The waters roil below. The pattern of activation in these regions predicts moral decisions better than does the DLPFC's profile. And this matches behavior. People punish to the extent that they feel angered by someone acting unethically. People tend toward instantaneous moral reactions. Moreover, when subjects shift from judging non-moral elements of acts to moral ones, they make assessments faster. The antithesis of moral decision-making being about grinding cognition. Most strikingly, when facing a moral quandary, activation in the amygdala, VMPFC, and insula typically precedes DLPFC activation. Damage to these intuitionist brain regions makes moral judgments more pragmatic, even cold-hearted. Recall from Chapter 10 how people with damage to the emotional VMPFC readily advocate sacrificing one relative to save five strangers, something control subjects never do. Most telling is when we have strong moral opinions but can't tell why, something Haidt calls moral dumbfounding, followed by clunky post hoc rationalizing. Moreover, such moral decisions can differ markedly in different affective or visceral circumstances, generating very different rationalizations. Recall from the last chapter how people become more conservative in their social judgments when they're smelling a foul odor or sitting at a dirty desk. And then there's that doozy of a finding, knowing a judge's opinions about Plato, Nietzsche, Rawls, and any other philosopher whose name I just looked up, gives you less predictive power about her judicial decisions than knowing if she's hungry. The social intuitionist roots of morality are bolstered further by evidence of moral judgment in two classes of individuals with limited capacities for moral reasoning. Again, with babies and animals. Much as infants demonstrate the rudiments of hierarchical and us-them thinking, they possess building blocks of moral reasoning as well. For starters, infants have the bias concerning commission versus omission. In one clever study, 6-month-olds watched a scene containing two of the same objects, one blue and one red. Repeatedly, the scene would show a person picking the blue object. Then, one time, the red one is picked. The kid becomes interested, looks more, breathes faster, showing that this seems discrepant. Now, the scene shows two of the same objects, one blue, one a different color. In each repetition of the scene, a person picks the one that is not blue. Its color changes with each repetition. Suddenly, the blue one is picked. The kid isn't particularly interested. He always picks the blue one, is easier to comprehend than he never picks the blue one. Commission is weightier. Infants and toddlers also have hints of a sense of justice, as shown by Kylie Hamlin of the University of British Columbia and Paul Bloom and Karen Wynn of Yale. 6 to 12-month-olds watch a circle moving up a hill. A nice triangle helps to push it. A mean square blocks it. Afterward, the infants can reach for a triangle or a square. They choose the triangle. Do infants prefer nice beings or shun mean ones? Both. Nice triangles were preferred over neutral shapes, which were preferred over mean squares. Such infants advocate punishing bad acts. A kid watches puppets, one good, one bad, sharing versus not. The child is then presented with the puppets, each sitting on a pile of sweets. Who should lose a sweet? The bad puppet. Who should gain one? The good puppet. Remarkably, toddlers even assess secondary punishment. The good and bad puppets then interact with two additional puppets who can be nice or bad. And whom did kids prefer of those second-layer puppets? Those who were nice to nice puppets and those who punished mean ones. Other primates also show the beginnings of moral judgments. Things started with a superb 2003 paper by Franz Duval and Sarah Brosnan. Capuchin monkeys were trained in a task. A human gives them a mildly interesting small object, a pebble. The human then extends her hand palm up, a capuchin begging gesture. If the monkey puts the pebble in her hand, there's a food reward. In other words, the animals learned how to buy food. Now there are two capuchins side by side. Each gets a pebble. Each gives it to the human. Each gets a grape, very rewarding. Now change things. Both monkeys pay their pebble. Monkey 1 gets a grape, but monkey 2 gets some cucumber, which blows compared with grapes. Capuchins prefer grapes to cucumber 90% of the time. Monkey 2 was shortchanged. And monkey 2 would then typically fling the cucumber at the human or bash around in frustration. Most consistently, they wouldn't give the pebble the next time. As the Nature paper was entitled, "Monkeys Reject Unequal Pay." This response has since been demonstrated in various macaque monkey species, crows, ravens, and dogs, where the dog's work would be shaking her paw. Footnote. Dogs differed from primates in two interesting ways that make sense, both dog-wise and primate-wise. Primates would get pissed and stop working if there was a difference in the quality of the reward, grape versus cucumber. In contrast, dogs didn't distinguish quality, bread versus sausage, only whether one was rewarded and the other not. Second, while many monkeys refused to accept an eventual reward and would never cooperate again, dogs all eventually came around after enough entreaties to shake by the human. Subsequent work by Brosnan, Duval, and others fleshed out this phenomenon further. One criticism of the original study was that maybe capuchins refused to work for cucumbers because grapes were visible, regardless of whether the other guy was getting paid in grapes. But no, the phenomenon required unfair payment. Both animals are getting grapes, then one gets switched to cucumber. What's key, that the other guy is still getting grapes, or that I no longer am? The former. If doing the study with a single monkey, switching from grapes to cucumbers would not evoke refusal, nor would it if both monkeys got cucumbers. Across the various species, males were more likely than females to reject lower pay. Dominant animals were more likely than subordinates to reject. It's about the work. Give one monkey a free grape, the other free cucumber, and the latter doesn't get pissed. The closer in proximity the two animals are, the more likely the one getting cucumber is to go on strike. Finally, rejection of unfair pay isn't seen in species that are solitary, e.g. orangutans, or have minimal social cooperation, e.g. owl monkeys. Okay, very impressive. Other social species show hints of a sense of justice, reacting negatively to an unequal reward. But this is worlds away from juries awarding money to plaintiffs harmed by employers. Instead, it's self-interest. This isn't fair. I'm getting screwed. How about evidence of a sense of fairness in the treatment of another individual? Two studies have examined this in a chimp version of the ultimatum game. Recall the human version. In repeated rounds, player one in a pair decides how money is divided between the two of them. Player two is powerless in the decision-making, but if unhappy with a split, can refuse and no one gets any money. In other words, player two can forego immediate reward to punish selfish player one. As we saw in chapter 10, player twos tend to accept 60-40 splits. In the chimp version, chimp one, the proposer, has two tokens. One indicates that each chimp gets two grapes. The other indicates that the proposer gets three grapes, the partner only one. The proposer chooses a token and passes it to chimp two, who then decides whether to pass the token to the human grape dispenser. In other words, if chimp two thinks chimp one is being unfair, no one gets grapes. In one such study, Michael Tomasello, a frequent critic of Duvall, stay tuned, at the Max Planck Institutes in Germany, found no evidence of chimp fairness. The proposer always chose, and the partner always accepted unfair splits. Duvall and Brosnan did the study in more ethologically valid conditions and reported something different. Proposer chimps tended toward equitable splits, but if they could give the token directly to the human, robbing chimp 2 of veto power, they'd favor unfair splits. So chimps will opt for fairer splits, but only when there is a downside to being unfair. Sometimes other primates are fair when it's at no cost to themselves. Back to capuchin monkeys. Monkey 1 chooses whether both he and the other guy get marshmallows, or it's a marshmallow for him and yucky celery for the other guy. Monkeys tended to choose marshmallows for the other guy. Similar other regarding preference was shown with marmoset monkeys, where the first individual got nothing and merely chose whether the other guy got a cricket to eat. Of note, a number of studies have failed to find other regarding preference in chimps. Really interesting evidence for a non-human sense of justice comes in a small side study in a Brosnan-Duvall paper. Back to the two monkeys getting cucumbers for work. Suddenly, one guy gets shifted to grapes. As we saw, the one still getting the cucumber refuses to work. Fascinatingly, the grape mogul often refuses as well. What is this? Solidarity? I'm no strike-breaking scab? Self-interest, but with an atypically long view about the possible consequences of the cucumber victim's resentment? Scratch an altruistic capuchin and a hypocritical one bleeds? In other words, all the questions raised by human altruism. Given the relatively limited reasoning capacities of monkeys, these findings support the importance of social intuitionism. Duvall perceives even deeper implications. The roots of human morality are older than our cultural institutions, than our laws and sermons. Rather than human morality being spiritually transcendent, enter deity stage right, it transcends our species boundaries. Mr. Spock and Joseph Stalin. Many moral philosophers believe not only that moral judgment is built on reasoning, but also that it should be. This is obvious to fans of Mr. Spock, since the emotional component of moral intuitionism just introduces sentimentality, self-interest, and parochial biases. but one remarkable finding counters this. Relatives are special. Chapter 10 attests to that. Any social organism would tell you so. Joseph Stalin thought so concerning Pavlik Morozov ratting out his father. As do most American courts, where there is either de facto or de jure resistance to making someone testify against their own parent or child. Relatives are special, but not to people lacking social intuitionism. As noted, people with VMPFC damage make extraordinarily practical, unemotional moral decisions. And in the process, they do something that everyone, from clonal yeast to Uncle Joe to the Texas rules of criminal evidence, considers morally suspect. They advocate harming kin as readily as strangers in an is-it-okay-to-sacrifice-one-person-to-save-five scenario. Emotion and social intuition are not some primordial ooze that gums up that human specialty of moral reasoning. Instead, they anchor some of the few moral judgments that most humans agree upon. Context. So social intuitions can have large, useful roles in moral decision-making. Should we now debate whether reasoning or intuition is more important? This is silly, not least of all because there is considerable overlap between the two. Consider, for example, protesters shutting down a capital to highlight income inequity. This could be framed as the Kohlbergian reasoning of people in a post-conventional stage. But it could also be framed a la Haidt in a social intuitionist way. These are people who resonate more with moral intuitions about fairness than with respect for authority. More interesting than squabbling about the relative importance of reasoning and intuition are two related questions. What circumstances bias toward emphasizing one over the other? Can the differing emphases produce different decisions? As we've seen, then-graduate student Josh Green and colleagues helped jumpstart neuroethics by exploring these questions using the poster child of Do the Ends Justify the Means philosophizing, namely the runaway trolley problem. A trolley's brake has failed, and it is hurtling down the tracks and will hit and kill five people. Is it okay to do something that saves the five but kills someone else in the process? People have pondered this since Aristotle took his first trolley ride. Green et al. Added neuroscience. Subjects were neuroimaged while pondering trolley ethics. Crucially, they considered two scenarios. Scenario one, here comes the trolley, five people are goners. Would you pull a lever that diverts the trolley onto a different track where it will hit and kill someone? The original scenario. Scenario two, same circumstance. Would you push the person onto the tracks to stop the trolley? By now, I bet readers can predict which brain region or regions activate in each circumstance. Contemplate pulling the lever, and DLPFC activity predominates, the detached cerebral profile of moral reasoning. Contemplate consigning the person to death by pushing them, and it's VMPFC and amygdala, the visceral profile of moral intuition. Would you pull the lever? Consistently, 60-70% of people, with their DLPFCs churning away, say yes to this utilitarian solution. Kill one to save five. Would you push the person with your own hands? Only 30% are willing. The more the VMPFC and/or amygdaloid activation, the more likely they are to refuse. This is hugely important. A relatively minor variable determines whether people emphasize moral reasoning or intuition, and they engage different brain circuits in the process, producing radically different decisions. Green has explored this further. Are people resistant to the utilitarian trade-off of killing one to save five in the pushing scenario because of the visceral reality of actually touching the person whom they have consigned to death? Green's work suggests not. If instead of pushing with your hands, you push with a pole, people are still resistant. There's something about the personal force involved that fuels the resistance. Are people willing in the lever scenario because the victim is at a distance rather than right in front of them? Probably not. People are just as willing if the lever is right next to the person who will die. Green suggests that intuitions about intentionality are key. In the lever scenario, the five people are saved because the trolley has been diverted to another track. The killing of the individual is a side effect, and the five would still have been saved if that person hadn't been standing on the tracks. In contrast, in the pushing scenario, the five are saved because the person is killed, and the intentionality feels intuitively wrong. As evidence, Green would give subjects another scenario. Here comes the trolley, and you are rushing to throw a switch that will halt it. Is it okay to do this if you know that in the process of lunging for the switch, you must push a person out of the way who falls to the ground and dies? About 80% of people say yes. Same pushing the person, same proximity, but done unintentionally as a side effect. The person wasn't killed as a means to save the five, which seems much more okay. Now a complication. In the loop scenario, you pull a lever that diverts the trolley to another track. But, oh no, it's just a loop. It merges back onto the original track. The trolley will still kill the five people, except that there's a person on the side loop who will be killed, stopping the trolley. This is as intentional a scenario as is pushing with your hands. Diverting to another track isn't enough. The person has to be killed. By all logic, only about 30% of people should sign on, but instead, it's in the 60 to 70% range. Green concludes, from this and additional scenarios resembling the loop, that the intuitionist universe is very local. Killing someone intentionally as a means to save five feels intuitively wrong, but the intuition is strongest when the killing would occur right here, right now. Doing it in more complicated sequences of intentionality doesn't feel as bad. This is not because of a cognitive limit. It's not that subjects don't realize the necessity of killing the person in the loop scenario. It just doesn't feel the same. In other words, intuitions discount heavily over space and time. Exactly the myopia about cause and effect you'd expect from a brain system that operates rapidly and automatically. This is the same sort of myopia that makes sins of commission feel worse than those of omission. Thus, these studies suggest that when a sacrifice of one requires active, intentional, and local actions, more intuitive brain circuitry is engaged, and ends don't justify means. And in circumstances where either the harm is unintentional or the intentionality plays out at a psychological distance, different neural circuitry predominates, producing an opposite conclusion about the morality of ends and means. These trolleyology studies raise a larger point, which is that moral decision-making can be wildly context-dependent. Often the key thing that a change in context does is alter the locality of one's intuitionist morals, as summarized by Dan Ariely of Duke University in his wonderful book, Predictably Irrational. Leave money around a common work area and no one takes it. It's not okay to steal money. Leave some cans of Coke and they're all taken. The one-step distance from the money involved blunts the intuitions about the wrongness of stealing, making it easier to start rationalizing, e.g., someone must have left them out for the taking. The effects of proximity on moral intuitionism are shown in a thought experiment by Peter Singer. You're walking by a river in your hometown. You see that a child has fallen in. Most people feel morally obliged to jump in and save the child, even if the water destroys their $500 suit. Alternatively, a friend in Somalia calls and tells you about a poor child there who will die without $500 worth of medical care. Can you send money? Typically not. The locality and moral discounting over distance is obvious. The child in danger in your hometown is far more of an us than is this dying child far away. And this is an intuitive rather than cognitive core. If you were walking along in Somalia and saw a child fall into a river, you'd be more likely to jump in and sacrifice the suit than to send $500 to that friend making the phone call. Someone being right there, in the flesh, in front of our eyes, is a strong, implicit prime that they are an us. Moral context dependency can also revolve around language, as noted in Chapter 3. Recall, for example, people using different rules about the morality of cooperation if you call the same economic game the Wall Street game or the community game. Framing an experimental drug as having a 5% mortality rate versus a 95% survival rate produces different decisions about the ethics of using it. Framing also taps into the themes of people having multiple identities, belonging to multiple us groups and hierarchies. This was shown in a hugely interesting 2014 Nature paper by Alain Cohn and colleagues at the University of Zurich. Subjects who worked for an unnamed international bank played a coin toss game with financial rewards for guessing outcomes correctly. Crucially, the game's design made it possible for subjects to cheat at various points, and for the investigators to detect the cheating. In one version, subjects first completed a questionnaire filled with mundane questions about their everyday lives, e.g., how many hours of television do you watch each week? This produced a low, baseline level of cheating. Then, in the experimental version, the questionnaire was about their bank job. Questions like these primed the subjects to implicitly think more about banking, e.g., they became more likely in a word task to complete ochre with broker than with smoker. So subjects were thinking about their banking identity, and when they did, rates of cheating rose 20%. Priming people in other professions, e.g. manufacturing, to think about their jobs or about the banking world didn't increase cheating. These bankers carried in their heads two different sets of ethical rules concerning cheating, banking and non-banking, and unconscious cueing brought one or the other to the forefront. Know thyself, especially in differing contexts. But this circumstance is different. The context dependency of morality is crucial in an additional realm. It is a nightmare of a person who, with remorseless sociopathy, believes it is okay to steal, kill, rape, and plunder. But far more of humanity's worst behaviors are due to a different kind of person, namely most of the rest of us, who will say that of course it is wrong to do X, but here is why these special circumstances make me an exception right now. We use different brain circuits when contemplating our own moral failings, heavy activation of the VMPFC versus those of others, more of the insula and DLPFC. And we consistently make different judgments, being more likely to exempt ourselves than others from moral condemnation. Why? Part of it is simply self-serving. Sometimes a hypocrite bleeds because you've scratched a hypocrite. The difference may also reflect different emotions being involved when we analyze our own actions versus those of others. Considering the moral failings of the latter may evoke anger and indignation, while their moral triumphs prompt emulation and inspiration. In contrast, considering our own moral failings calls forth shame and guilt, while our triumphs elicit pride. The affective aspects of going easy on ourselves are shown when stress makes us more this way. When experimentally stressed, subjects make more egoistic, rationalizing judgments regarding emotional moral dilemmas and are less likely to make utilitarian judgments, but only when the latter involve a personal moral issue. Moreover, the bigger the glucocorticoid response to the stressor, the more this is the case. Going easy on ourselves also reflects a key cognitive fact. We judge ourselves by our internal motives, and everyone else by their external actions. And thus, in considering our own misdeeds, we have more access to mitigating situational information. This is straight out of us, them. When thems do something wrong, it's because they're simply rotten. When uses do it, it's because of an extenuating circumstance, and me is the most focal us there is, coming with the most insight into internal state. Thus, on this cognitive level, there is no inconsistency or hypocrisy. And we might readily perceive a wrong to be mitigated by internal motives in the case of anyone's misdeeds. It's just easier to know those motives when we are the perpetrator. The adverse consequences of this are wide and deep. Moreover, the pull toward judging yourself less harshly than others easily resists the rationality of deterrence. As Ariely writes in his book, overall, cheating is not limited by risk. It is limited by our ability to rationalize the cheating to ourselves. cultural context. So people make different moral judgments about the same circumstance depending on whether it's about them or someone else, which of their identities has been primed, the language used, how many steps the intentionality is removed, and even the levels of their stress hormones, the fullness of their stomach, or the smelliness of their environment. After Chapter 9, it is no surprise that moral decision-making can also vary dramatically by culture. One culture's sacred cow is another's meal, and the discrepancy can be agonizing. When thinking about cross-cultural differences in morality, key issues are what universals of moral judgment exist and whether the universals or the differences are more interesting and important. Chapter 9 noted some moral stances that are virtually universal, whether de facto or de jure. These include condemnation of at least some forms of murder and of theft. Oh, and of some form of sexual practice. More broadly, there is the near universal of the golden rule, with cultures differing as to whether it is framed as do only things you'd want done to you, or don't do things you wouldn't want done to you. Amid the power of its simplicity, the golden rule does not incorporate people differing as to what they would/wouldn't want done to them. We have entered complicated terrain when we can make sense of an interchange where a masochist says, "Beat me," and the sadist sadistically answers, "No." This criticism is overcome with the use of a more generalized, common currency of reciprocity, where we are enjoined to give concern and legitimacy to the needs and desires of people in circumstances where we would want the same done for us. Cross-cultural universals of morality arise from shared categories of rules of moral behavior. The anthropologist Richard Schwader has proposed that all cultures recognize rules of morality pertinent to autonomy, community, and divinity. As we saw in the last chapter, Jonathan Haidt breaks this continuum into his foundations of morality that humans have strong intuitions about. These are issues related to harm, fairness and reciprocity, both of which Schwader would call autonomy, in-group loyalty and respect for authority, both of which Schwader would call community, and issues of purity and sanctity, i.e., Schwader's realm of divinity. The existence of universals of morality raises the issue of whether that means that they should trump more local, provincial moral rules. Between the moral absolutists on one side and the relativists on the other, people like the historian of science Michael Shermer argue reasonably for provisional morality. If a moral stance is widespread across cultures, start off by giving the benefit of the doubt to its importance, but watch your wallet. It's certainly interesting that, for example, all cultures designate certain things as sacred, but it is far more so to look at the variability in what is considered sacred, how worked up people get when such sanctity is violated, and what is done to keep such violations from reoccurring. I'll touch on this huge topic with three subjects: cross-cultural differences concerning the morality of cooperation and competition, affronts to honor, and the reliance on shame versus guilt. Cooperation and competition. Some of the most dramatic cross-cultural variability in moral judgment concerns cooperation and competition. This is shown to an extraordinary extent in a 2008 science paper by a team of British and Swiss economists. Subjects played a public good economic game where players begin with a certain number of tokens and then decide, in each of a series of rounds, how many to contribute to a shared pool. The pool is then multiplied and shared evenly among all the players. The alternative to contributing is for subjects to keep the tokens for themselves. Thus, the worst payoff for an individual player would be if they contributed all their tokens to the pool, while no other player contributed any. The best would be if the individual contributed no tokens and everyone else contributed everything. As a feature of the design, subjects could pay to punish other players for the size of their contribution. Subjects were from around the world. First finding. Across all cultures, people were more pro-social than sheer economic rationality would predict. If everyone played in the most brutally asocial, realpolitik manner, no one would contribute to the pool. Instead, subjects from all cultures consistently contributed. Perhaps as an explanation, subjects from all cultures punished people who made lowball contributions and to roughly equal extents. Where the startling difference came was with a behavior that I'd never even seen before in the behavioral economics literature, something called antisocial punishment. Free-riding punishment is when you punish another player for contributing less than you, i.e. being selfish. Antisocial punishment is when you punish another player for contributing more than you, i.e. being generous. What is that about? Interpretation. This hostility towards someone being overly generous is because they're going to up the ante, and soon everyone, i.e. me, will be expected to be generous. Kill 'em, spoiling things for everyone. It's a phenomenon where you punish someone for being nice, because what if that sort of crazy deviance becomes the norm and you feel pressure to be nice back? At one extreme, where subjects from countries, the United States and Australia, where this weird antisocial punishment was nearly non-existent. And at the mind-boggling other extreme were subjects from Oman and Greece, who were willing to spend more to punish generosity than to punish selfishness. And this was not a comparison of, say, theologians in Boston with Omani pirates. Subjects were all urban university students. So what's different among these cities? The authors found a key correlation. The lower the social capital in a country, the higher the rates of antisocial punishment. In other words, when do people's moral systems include the idea that being generous deserves punishment? When they live in a society where people don't trust one another and feel as if they have no efficacy. Fascinating work has also been done specifically on people in non-Western cultures, as reported in a pair of studies by Joseph Henrich of the University of British Columbia and colleagues. Subjects were in the thousands and came from 25 different small-scale cultures from around the world. They were nomadic pastoralists, hunter-gatherers, sedentary forager/horticulturalists, and subsistence farmers/wage earners. There were two control groups, namely urbanites from Missouri and Accra, Ghana. As a particularly thorough feature of the study, subjects played three economic games. A, the dictator game, where the subject simply decides how much money is split between them and another player. This measures a pure sense of fairness, independent of consequence. B, the ultimatum game, where you can pay to punish someone treating you unfairly, i.e. self-interested second-party punishment. C, a third-party punishment scenario, where you can pay to punish someone treating a third party unfairly, i.e. altruistic punishment. The authors identified three fascinating variables that predicted patterns of play. Market integration. How much do people in a culture interact economically with trade items? The authors operationalized this as the percentage of people's calories that came from purchases in market interactions, and it ranged from 0% for the hunter-gathering Hadza of Tanzania to nearly 90% for sedentary fishing cultures. And across the cultures, a greater degree of market integration strongly predicted people making fairer offers in all three games, and being willing to pay for both self-interested second-party and altruistic third-party punishment of creeps. For example, the Hadza, at one extreme, kept an average of 73% of the spoils for themselves in the dictator game, while the sedentary fishing Sankianga of Colombia, along with people in the United States and Accra, approached dictating a 50-50 split. Market integration predicts more willingness to punish selfishness and, no surprise, less selfishness. Community size. The bigger the community, the more the incidence of second and third party punishment of cheapskates. Hadza, for example, in their tiny bands of 50 or fewer, would pretty much accept any offer above zero in the ultimatum game. There was no punishment. At the other extreme, in communities of 5,000 or more, sedentary agriculturalists and aquaculturalists, plus the Ghanaian and American urbanites, offers that weren't in the ballpark of 50-50 were typically rejected and/or punished. Religion. What percentage of the population belonged to a worldwide religion, i.e. Christianity or Islam? This ranged from none of the Hadza to 60 to 100% for all the other groups. the greater the incidence of belonging to a Western religion, the more third-party punishment, i.e., willingness to pay to punish person A for being unfair to person B. What to make of these findings? First, the religion angle. This was a finding not about religiosity generally, but about religiosity within a worldwide religion, and not about generosity or fairness, but about altruistic third-party punishment. What is it about worldwide religions? As we saw in Chapter 9, it is only when groups get large enough that people regularly interact with strangers that cultures invent moralizing gods. These are not gods who sit around the banquet table laughing with detachment at the foibles of humans down below, or gods who punish humans for lousy sacrificial offerings. These are gods who punish humans for being rotten to other humans. In other words, the large religions invent gods who do third-party punishment. No wonder this predicts these religions' adherents being third-party punishers themselves. Next, the twin findings that more market integration and bigger community size were associated with fairer offers for the former and more willingness to punish unfair players for both. I find this to be a particularly challenging pair of findings, especially when framed as the authors thoughtfully did. The authors ask where the uniquely extreme sense of fairness comes from in humans, particularly in the context of large-scale societies with strangers frequently interacting. And they offer two traditional types of explanations that are closely related to our dichotomies of intuition versus reasoning and animal roots versus cultural inventions. Our moral anchoring in fairness in large-scale societies is a residue and extension of our hunter-gatherer and non-human primate past. This was life in small bands, where fairness was mostly driven by kin selection and easy scenarios of reciprocal altruism. As our community size has expanded, and we now mostly have one-shot interactions with unrelated strangers, our pro-sociality just represents an expansion of our small-band mindset, as we use various green beard marker shibboleths as proxies for relatedness. I'd gladly lay down my life for two brothers, eight cousins, or a guy who is a fellow Packers fan. The moral underpinnings of a sense of fairness lie in cultural institutions and mindsets that we invented as our groups became larger and more sophisticated, as reflected in the emergence of markets, cash economies, and the like. This many pages in, it's obvious that I think the former scenario is pretty powerful. Look, we see the roots of a sense of fairness and justice in the egalitarian nature of nomadic hunter-gatherers, in other primates, in infants, in the preeminent limbic rather than cortical involvement. But inconveniently for that viewpoint, that's totally counter to what emerges from these studies. Across the 25 cultures, it's the hunter-gatherers, the ones most like our ancestors, living in the smallest groups, with the highest degrees of relatedness, and with the least reliance on market interactions, who show the least tendency toward making fair offers and are least likely to punish unfairness, whether to themselves or to the other guy. None of that pro-sociality is there. A picture counter to what we saw in Chapter 9. I think an explanation is that these economic games tap into a very specific and artificial type of pro-sociality. We tend to think of market interactions as being the epitome of complexity, finding a literal common currency for the array of human needs and desires in the form of this abstraction called money. But at their core, market interactions represent an impoverishment of human reciprocity. In its natural form, human reciprocity is a triumph of comfortably and intuitively doing long-term math with apples and oranges. This guy over here is a superstar hunter. That other guy isn't in his league, but has your back if there's a lion around. Meanwhile, she's amazing at finding the best mongongo nuts. That older woman knows all about medicinal herbs, and that geeky guy remembers the best stories. We know where one another live. The debit columns even out over time. And if someone is really abusing the system, we'll get around to collectively dealing with them. In contrast, at its core, a cash economy market interaction strips it all down to, I give you this now, so you give me that now. Myopic, present tense interactions whose obligations of reciprocity must be balanced immediately. People in small-scale societies are relatively new to functioning this way. It's not the case that small-scale cultures that are growing big and market-reliant are newly schooled in how to be fair. Instead, they're newly schooled in how to be fair in the artificial circumstances modeled by something like the ultimatum game. Honor and revenge. Another realm of cross-cultural differences in moral systems concerns what constitutes appropriate response to personal affronts. This harks back to Chapter 9's Cultures of Honor, from Maasai tribesmen to traditional American Southerners. As we saw, such cultures have historical links to monotheism, warrior age groups, and pastoralism. To recap, such cultures typically see an unanswered challenge to honor as the start of a disastrous slippery slope, rooted in the intrinsic vulnerability of pastoralism. While no one can raid farmers and steal all their crops, someone can rustle a herd overnight, and if this son of a bitch gets away with insulting my family, he'll be coming for my cattle next. These are cultures that place a high moral emphasis on revenge, and revenge at least in kind. After all, an eye for an eye was probably the invention of Judaic pastoralists. The result is a world of Hatfields and McCoys with their escalating vendettas. This helps explain why the elevated murder rates in the American